Welcome back to Following Noadon, a Stormlight podcast. This week is episode 217, and we are finishing Tress of the Emerald Sea, chapters 43 all the way through the epilogue. Elliot, how are you?
There are not enough words to describe that awesome feeling when you finish a Sanderson book and just that sense of accomplishment that you feel. I was thinking about it this week, actually. You know, that kind of hit, that dopamine hit you get of finishing something small that only lasts, you know, a minute or two. Finishing a book like this, that's, you know, a bit of a journey, like lasts you a whole week. You just go the whole week. You're just like, ah, oh, yeah, that was a good story. That you just have that moment like over and over and over again. That's been my week.
Paul, how are you?
Fantastic. I think Elliot said it pretty well. This is a very, I think what I like about the Secret Projects is it's a very good sized book. You know, it's long enough to tell a good, fun, thorough story, but it's something that you could pick up and just read in a week or a couple days or something like that, you know, if you wanted to, rather than committing your life to it, such as the Stormlight Archive. Except I know many of our listeners will read a Stormlight book in 2 days max, you know? Yeah. So I'm talking about this myself. It would take me forever. Audiobook or physically reading it, it would take me a long time. So
I've been talking with Tim and David on our special episode podcast about how they're going to finish Stormlight for the foreseeable future, like by the end of December. And I'm planning to read it blind with you guys. So I'll hold on to it until like June. So, or later. So we're asking a bunch of questions on the other podcast of when will we know like a specific answer to some questions that are coming up. And they're thinking like, oh, we'll know this in a couple months. And I'm thinking, no, I won't know this until June. But, you know, that's fine. Let's roll intro. And we will get a brief summary of the end of Tress from Elliot. All right, Paul. Do we have a patron?
We do. I'm happy to say we have a patron. We get to talk about today. A very fun, and I realize I would like to say a quick thank you to Ingen, actually. I think she's one of our, this is not who I'm shouting out for the as a patron, but she commented on one of our videos and said, Paul, stop making fun of your own handwriting. We can read it just fine. So I'm not going to say anything negative about my handwriting other than it was a longer name and it's kind of spread. So I'm going to have to turn my cup a bit, but I would like to say a very special thank you to Grandma Juju, who we have here. And I have the light in front of me this time, so it's going to reflect a bit, but Grandma Juju is our newest surgeon. And I feel like if I was ever injured, there's no one I would want taking care of me other than Grandma Juju. I just feel like they're going to provide excellent emotional support. So thank you to Grandma Juju, our newest surgeon. Very much appreciated the support from you and from all of our listeners. So,
yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Elliot. I gave you, 18 chapters to summarize an entire Sanderlanch plus some. So go ahead.
Okay. I chuckled. You said brief intro as you were leading into me. We'll see how brief this actually is going to be.
I think we should give Elliot a 2 minute clock.
There's only two scenes. It's only two scenes. So you'll be fine.
All right.
Anyway, we left Tress on the Crimson Sea as they were trying to figure out how to navigate the spikes that shoot up out of the Crimson Sea when water hits it. As they're sailing the Crimson Sea, Tress is testing out her flare gun, trying to come up with a design that can take down Crow. She's got the Verdant ether that she's going to shoot out and have the vines wrap her up. So she tests that on a couple of different people as she's getting that ready. They do make it to the Lunagree, kind of the center of the Crimson Sea. And they find the dragon. Before we get to the dragon, though, some interesting things happen. They do decide that they're going to mutiny. So they've made enough progress with the flare gun that the crew decides, okay, we got to do this. Crow catches wind of it and beats them into submission, literally, as they try to mutiny on the ship. And Crow rather violently takes them down, breaks Fort's little speaking tablet, all without using her spores, by the way, which is definitely a bit of a statement. And then Crow is able to get the message to the dragon to open up the lair, and in they go. So they walk down through the ether spores in the Crimson Sea down into the lair of the dragon, and we get to see the literal traditional six-limbed double-winged dragon sitting down there doing his thing. And there's a nice little banter of wits as Crow tries to offer Tress to the dragon, and Tress turns around and offers Crow to the dragon. They have a little bit of a almost like a courtroom scene where the dragon's like, well, make your case. So they make their cases. Tress wins, comes back up out of the sea, brings with her a few boons that the dragon granted her, which I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit more. With Crow taken care of, onward they sail to the Midnight Sea and in search of the sorceress and her isles to go save Charlie. They get there. Tress decides to... Well, no, hold on. As we approach the Midnight Sea, it turns out that Huck and Hoyd are in cahoots to try and stop them, and they catch them throwing all the food overboard to try and get them to turn around and go back for more, I guess. So we kind of discover that Huck is maybe a bit of a traitor. Tress locks him up, but then ultimately ends up taking him with her in the rowboat out into the Midnight Sea. They encounter the very first Midnight Essence monster, and Huck pipes up and says, oh yeah, I've got free passage to the sorceress. Please take us there. And Tress is a little bit mind blown, I guess, by that. But sure enough, they take her straight to the sorceress. I'm not going to go through everything that happens with the sorceress. I'm sure we'll dive into a little bit of it. But bottom line, Huck is actually Charlie, who's been cursed to try and bring Tress to the sorceress. We discover the sorceress has all kinds of power, video cameras and rockets and you name it. The crew does follow behind Tress and Huck, which is extremely important because Hoyd is the counter to the sorceress. Getting Hoyd into the tower is what enables them to defeat the sorcerer, because Hoyd's got all the powers. They successfully do all of this, and Tress and Charlie get to go live happily ever after as pirates, I guess.
Nice job, Elliot. All right, Paul. Your moment has arrived. We have a dragon in a book from Dragonsteel. How do we feel?
Fantastic. I will say this is... I think Elliot mentioned this is a ordinary dragon, which if you can call a dragon ordinary, but a stereotypically accurate dragon. You know, he's got his wings, he's got his horns and his scales, and he's seemingly wise and maybe greedy and checks all the fantasy dragon stereotypes, which I think was fun. I think maybe I said this. I don't actually know if I said this in the previous episode or not. I don't remember. But I think I said I was hoping maybe for not the traditional dragon, but something a bit more inventive and creative. And I will say, while this was a traditional dragon, I was very amused by the courtroom dispute and scenario that we had with Tress and the dragon. I thought it was very amusing. And very fun, and I immensely enjoyed this. I feel like this lived up to my expectations of meeting a dragon in the Cosmere. those are my initial thoughts there. I think it lived up to the hype. I think Zeiss was really cool, and I thought it was neat. It was neat, I feel like, as the listener and the reader, to have Zeiss see the rationale, like the rationality of Tress as being good and honest and things like that versus our, you know, bad, greedy character. It was very rewarding and satisfying, I feel like, as the reader to see how that worked out.
Yeah, I agree. I put in the outline a normal dragon, which if you ask me what a stereotypical normal dragon would be, I would tell you Smaug. I think Smaug from The Hobbit would be my normal dragon. And we show up in the Crimson Sea. We've heard rumors of the dragon. Go down to his red crimson spore layer, something going on, I don't know. And they show up, and he's not malevolent. He's not like evil, but he accepts people in trades for boons. So however you would like to categorize that. But yeah, I was waiting for some sort of twist. I think I've asked you guys in a previous episode which one was going to be the twist, the sorceress or the dragon. Turns out it was the sorceress, because this dragon is pretty darn normal. You show up, you give him tribute, he gives you a boon. Like, that's pretty standard. I was expecting some sort of twist, and there really isn't until we get to the Midnight Sea. So
yeah, the only twist with the dragon seemed to be, and I think Hoyd talks about this, I guess he has a penchant for hoarding ideas and not gold. So he doesn't have a whole treasure trove of gold he's sitting on. He's a librarian. That's probably like oversimplifying. He likes ideas. He likes good banter and, yeah, philosophy maybe. I don't know. It was an interesting dragon encounter. I enjoyed it. I thought it was good. The art is fantastic in the book. When you flip that page to see that dragon stare at you on the next page is pretty awesome.
I have one question for you with the dragon. As a side note, I fully agree. The art is incredible. I kept telling myself I couldn't go look at the art, and it was literally right before we started recording now that I got to go actually look at it, and it is spectacular. It's so good. Very, as we said, traditional dragon, but the art does such incredible justice. Anyways, the question I wanted to ask y'all, I had feelings of like, why does this dragon employ so many people, and what do all these people do? I was kind of confused by that. He mentions like certain roles and stuff, like people who are sweepers and stuff like that, but I was a bit confused why a dragon needs so many employees underneath him. I felt like that was an odd thing. You know, I've seen lots of maybe a dragon with prisoners, or maybe a dragon, you know, seeking gold or things like that, but it just seemed like a bunch of servants and employees, and I thought that was kind of odd.
By the end of this book, I'm kind of left thinking, like, for the purposes of this story, the sorceress was the villain, and a very straightforward villain. Trevor, you said, where's the twist? You know, there's kind of a twist in like the identity of the sorceress, but not a twist in the motives of the sorceress. She's just there because she's cranky and mean and wants to be left alone. And people keep messing with her, and so she messes with them back and just kind of, I don't know. But at the end of the day, they kind of just chase the sorceress off, and I'm kind of left going, oh, okay, they chased off the grumpy old magic lady, and the dragon is still here. And I kind of wonder if the kind of bigger picture of this is the dragon is not antagonistic, but maybe perhaps the far more important, powerful being on this planet. That we kind of just, chased off the grumpy old lady, and actually going forward, what we should actually remember is that there's a dragon on this planet. And yes, what is he doing with all his employees sitting underneath an ether sea?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I have a good answer for you. You know as much about this planet now as I do. So the moving forward on this planet, if we ever do, yeah, I could see the dragon being antagonistic in the future, or him showing up somewhere else and being a problem for somebody else. So like you said, the sorceress at the end of the book leaves, and obviously from what she can accomplish, she wasn't from the planet originally. She kind of just set up shop as the sorceress on a planet that was not as technologically advanced, and then gets chased off by Hoid and Tress. So maybe she'll show up later as well.
Before we depart from our dragon friend, I have another question, and we don't have to rabbit trail too much, but we might rabbit trail a little bit with the dragon. So the question in my mind, you know, I've enjoyed this story. It's been wonderful. But, you know, of course, in the back of my mind, I have to think, what is our relevance? What am I learning about the Cosmere as a whole? And things like that. I think Dragons in the Cosmere is awesome. I'm always going to be here for it. I'm always going to approve. I think it's so cool. But I don't fully understand how dragons fit into the Cosmere. We have a lot of powerful beings. We have Khondra, but we understand when they were made. We understand what they can do, things like that. I feel like it's very rigid. We have, you know, other powerful things. You know, we have Spren. We have lots of stuff throughout the Cosmere, right? I don't understand where dragons may be have become powerful. Were they just, you know, created a long time ago by Aedo Nalsium and they're powerful? If that's the case, I'm fine with that. I can accept that. But to me, it's still kind of a gray area. I don't understand why. Why dragon, I guess. Why dragon know everything, you know? That was my beautiful phrasing. I'm sorry. But that's kind of the question I'm left with. I think this dragon was awesome, but I need more context. In every other story, you're like, yeah, dragon is just there and he's, you know, he's the big bad or something like that. This is a bit different. Whenever I think of Cosmere implications and knowing that there are other dragons, but they're not like besties hanging out together, you know, they're all doing their own thing. You know, I guess there's a bit of a gray area.
So I have the same question, but I think I'm going to reframe your question and ask it as well, as opposed to answer it for you. So up until this point, I was going to say maybe with the exception of Yumi, but I think even including Yumi, every book, either directly or indirectly, has asked the question, how does this shard fit into the picture, right? We've got a shard. How does it affect the Cosmere? How is it affecting other books tangentially, maybe behind the scenes, maybe directly? But it's all been about shards, putting Aedo Nalsium back together again, all of Hoid's horses and all of Hoid's men. So this book has maybe two or three references to shards, and they're not even in the book. They're to the listener. They're to whoever's Hoid is telling the story to. They're not in Tress. They're in the narrator dialogue. This book is bringing up like parallel issues of ethers and space travel and dragons. Where do the dragons come from? Is it an Aedo Nalsium thing, like you asked, Paul, or is it parallel with that, like ethers are? So we were told that ethers predate the shattering, but don't predate Aedo Nalsium necessarily. There was a correction in the book. So ask the same thing about dragons. Do dragons fit into the shard narrative that we have going through pretty much every Cosmere book? Or do they have their own thing going on? Are they spread out around the Cosmere with a unifying goal, or are they, you know, more like it, are they independent? Have they just gone and done their own thing for whoever, wherever they come from? I think the answer to that is Yolin. I think. Let me pause there for a second. What do you guys know about Yolin?
Nothing other than I recognize the name. I think we've heard it like maybe once somewhere, but
yeah, nothing. I don't think I remember Yolin.
So just a TLDR on Yolin. Yolin is where Hoyt is from. It has to do with Silverlight as well. Like it's one of the old worlds, like around the Adonalsium shattering thing. It was the most progressed world when the shattering happened. Yolin is like the old planet that nobody really knows about. It's out there somewhere, maybe super advanced, maybe it's desolate, nobody really knows. But anything old and creepy is probably from Yolin, ethers included.
Okay. That I remember mentioning that it's where Hoyt is from is the bell that rings. I remember that. In my mind, dragons are going in the same bucket as our sleepless friends.
Mm.
Like, yep. Something that's out there, a force that's out there that I don't fully understand when, where, what, and why, but it can hang around. I think it's pretty a neat addition to the Cosmere, and I don't need to know everything about it.
Sure. Yeah, so back to what you were saying, Paul, I don't know how much we're going to include dragons in the future. I know Brandon, kind of on his podcast, has always shied away from including your traditional fantasy races. Like, you know, he's a fan of dragons as much as the next person, but he also wants to explore other things, you know, like the sleepless, like the listeners, you know, come up with his own races and pursue them and stuff. So I don't know how involved, and I also don't know how much I want dragons involved. I enjoy this dragon. I want to see more dragons, but I don't know how much I do or how much more.
I think I really like the role that this dragon played. I think it's really neat to have in a story, but fairly isolated, not a dragon who's like, you know, whatever, to reformate Adonalsium one day at the end of the Cosmere story that Brandon writes or something like that. I don't know, wherever that goes. It's not going to be something like, we need to unite the 10 dragons as they're the most powerful, you know. Like, I think it's kind of good that they're kind of a powerful being that's kind of not good or bad and just kind of out there, and maybe our adventurers encounter a dragon and, you know, stuff like this. I think that's really neat, and I think that's a good role for this without becoming the into the spotlight, I guess. But anyways, we've talked about it for a while. I don't mean to hang us up on that, but those are just some of the thoughts I had. I mean, this is our first and only dragon, real dragon experience so far, so I had lots of thoughts and questions. So
there was one note in particular that I noticed in the description of Zeiss. It's clearly pointed out that he has this shiny, otherworldly metal, is the way it's described, like as part of his body in his like scales and armor. And then I think it's just straightforward told to us by narrator Hoyt, I think, that is dragon steel. Yep. There's our name drop of, we've heard about dragon steel. We know that it's the name of Hoyt's story, apparently, and the name of Brandon's company. And yet we haven't seen it at all in the story so far. And then here we go. Here's a dragon. And the dragon is clad in dragon steel, which is intriguing.
I'm just as intrigued as you. I have no answers.
It's kind of fun to have it this way, you know.
Trevor
can't sit back and smirk and make fun of us now, you know.
I've got one more book. I have one more book that I can do that. And that's it.
I've read enough Mistborn to know that metal can do powerful things. So I'm immediately on the lookout for, all right, what's the magic system built around dragons with dragon steel on their body. Intriguing.
There was one more single line comment after we're done with the dragon where Tress returns to the ship, gives each boon to her three officers that she cares deeply about. And then she says, I'm going to go take a nap and do not disturb me. I don't care if death himself, with spikes in his eyes, is trying to wake me up. Did you guys catch that single line?
Definitely.
The only thing I really wanted to point out here, it's not a huge thing, but that would certainly imply that, one, this is after Mistborn Era 2, or at least after Mistborn Era 1. Two, that Skadrian culture and religion has made its way to Lumar. And even if it's not like a overtly religious figure, it's still a phrase, a term that Tress is using. So I thought that was very interesting that Skadrian culture and religion or both has spilled over into Lumar at that point. How involved are the Skadrians at this point in the conflict? I think it's a very interesting idea.
Well, there's a very seemingly obvious answer to that question, which would be Ghostbloods. We know that the Ghostbloods are definitely involved in the Cosmere as a whole and are already, again, maybe the timeline question needs to get answered first here, but we know the Ghostbloods are active outside of Skadrial. Is it far-fetched to imagine there are Ghostbloods here on this planet and one of them has made, you know, regular offhand comments about death with nails in his eyes? Seems perfectly plausible, caught on, and is now a phrase in this culture too.
And it doesn't need to be a super big bunny trail, but when I read that for the first time, I thought, okay, why are the Skadrians here? Is there something on the planet that they were after?
Dragonsteel.
Dragonsteel, ethers. I mean, there's several things that they could learn from this planet. So I just thought that was very interesting. Paul, you asked this question earlier. Where in the timeline is Tress of the Emerald Sea? So when we get the answer to that question, apparently shortly after Stormlight 5 is published, we are going to get an official canon timeline from Brandon Sanderson with all published books in like a specific year on the timeline. So I'm very much looking forward to that, because then we can begin to pinpoint our world hoppers, when our worlds begin to reach out into the Cosmere, what's going on at the same times, et cetera, et cetera. I'm looking forward to that.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah, I'm super looking forward to that. That's my number one question. Whenever we see characters, whenever we, you know, any big shard event happens, I want to know when. When is this happening? To line it up. So that sounds awesome.
All right. Dragon down. Moving on to the Midnight Sea. Tress makes her way to the Sorceress's Island with Huck, Chuck, Charlie as a rat. And turns out, I really enjoy the Hoyt as a narrator in this scene, because he describes Tress walking into the Sorceress's castle or tower or whatever, and then let's slip the term laptop, and then also explains that Tress was looking at all the deep magical runes around the room. And Hoyd's like, to the educated eye, those would be aeons. But Tress isn't really that off by thinking that they're just cool magical runes, because that's basically what they are. So we learn pretty quickly that the sorceress is a grumpy old Elantrian lady with the full glowy skin and everything, just hanging out and cursing people for fun. So, yeah, what did you guys think of our last reveal of the book of the sorceress?
I thought the sequence was all pretty, pretty well done, pretty cool. I enjoyed the scenes for sure. Maybe the cheesiest part of it was the fake Charlie, as Tress goes in and the sorceress says, "Oh, here he is. You can have him." And then Charlie walks out with her, and Tress has the like realization of, "Oh, this is too perfect. This can't be true. This must be an illusion, or something to that." I think he even says light weaving at one point. Am I imagining that?
I think he does.
I think he uses the term light weaving. And all of that seemed a little goofy, I guess. But overall, I thought it was good. The sorceress makes a decent, slightly comical villain as they're kind of bantering and eventually shooting spells back and forth at each other. I did realize, well, I have a confession. I have a confession to make to you guys. I have cheated. I've abused my new powers and access to the dark magics that are now available to me. We get a name for the sorceress in this sequence. You audiobook people have to help me out because it's an Elantrian name and they're kind of weird. It's like
Rhyaina.
It's Rhyaina.
Is it Rhyaina? I thought it was
Rhyaina. Rhyaina. Okay. I do remember this one of Rhyaina.
Rhyaina is probably what I would have guessed, but okay, Rhyaina. So I saw that name, and yeah, first thought like, okay, Elantrian. We got it. This lady's definitely Elantrian. But two, I was going, okay, we've seen that name before. I don't remember where though. I couldn't remember where. So I did open up the dark magics of the Copper Mind in order to find out. I finished the book first, and then I went and I looked up what who she was, and did discover. We've seen her before.
Oh, okay. Before you point it out, I don't want to be like, you know, I think that's perfectly fine. I specifically did not look it up because I didn't know if we were going to speculate or try to guess what we remembered. So I want to throw out my guess because I don't know for sure. I don't know if that's stealing your thunder, Elliot, but
please go guess for it.
I heard the name Rhyaina and I was like, I know this is someone we've seen before. And it was driving me crazy trying to remember. My best guess is I think this was the keeper of what was the name? Shai in Emperor's Soul. That was my guess, is that this was someone from Emperor's Soul, but I could be wrong. But that was the only guess that I had. I couldn't remember Rhyaina.
That's a really good guess. I'm on the lookout for those people too from the Emperor's Soul, because that's all from the planet Cell, right? So to have Elantrians coming through there would make sense. It's not though. It's different.
Okay.
You and I walked very different paths. I had the exact same thoughts. It was torturing me who this was. I know we'd seen her before. So, and I gave in to the temptation and looked it up. The answer is we met her in Mistborn's Secret History. Kelsier stumbles across her when he meets the Eyrie. Do you remember them? He like mm-hmm. goes out across when they're
on the back side of the world or wherever.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
And they have this like cooked up plan that they're going to use this device they have to have one of them capture the shard preservation, I think, is who they're after.
Yep. They're waiting for preservation to finally die, and then they're going to go capture it.
Yeah. And we discovered even then that they were Elantrian, and we were going, oh man, what are all the Elantrians up to? Rhyaina was one of those in those scenes.
Now that you guys know this, I finally get to talk about how many Elantrians are written into other pieces of work. It blows right? my mind that all Brandon wants to do is talk about Elantris in other books that he writes, because I know there are plenty of people who skip Elantris because they assume it's like Brandon's weakest work. I'm not going to bother with it. Brandon puts so many Elantrians in just random places in all sorts of different things. And yeah, this Elliot, you're correct. The Copper Mine's obviously correct that this is the Orb Lady who is trying to steal Preservation Shard and ends up on Lumar doing research or something. I don't know what she's up to, but yeah. So we've got Elantrians everywhere, I guess.
Yeah, even our last story had Elantrians popping in, saving the day in the Lost Metal. They're all over the place.
Lost Metal, Rhythm of War.
And now, maybe even the bigger drop out of all this, Hoid.
Yeah, so in the last chapter, Hoid makes a bet, or this was his curse. He makes a bet with the sorceress to become an Elantrian if I can get back in your tower. And he just shows up and starts drawing Aeons at the end of the book. So, I mean, I've made this joke before on the podcast, but Hoid is really just going for the Infinity Gauntlet of all the powers.
Seriously.
He's got Mistborn powers. He's a Light Weaver, you know, he's got everything.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up if you didn't mention it, Trevor. This was just another Infinity Stone for him. He's really like, I don't even know what to say. He's just got to be the most powerful investiture-wise. Like, he's just got everything, the best of everything you can get just about. So,
and I got to ask, is Hoid collecting all these powers for something specific? Or is he just a compulsive collector? And he's well-traveled, so he's seen all the magic places, and he's like, oh, I want all of that. And just is spending his entire time going around and doing all the things on the different planets to acquire all the powers. Or does he have a goal in mind? Does he have a specific goal where he needs a dozen different magical powers to do it?
So this actually goes all the way back to the Way of Kings, where Hoid talks to Dalinar and tells him that he would let Roshar burn in the blink of an eye if it served his purposes. So to answer your question, Hoid has a goal. Whatever it is, recombining Aeon Alsium, you know, keeping Aeon Alsium as separate as possible, whatever you want to postulate may have nothing to do with the shards, you know, whatever. I do think Hoid has a specific goal, and it's taken him a while to do it, because these books in the timelines are spread out pretty heavily as far as just normal standard Skadrian years go. So
I gotta say this too. I am bookmarking this segment of this book because I think it's going to be worth coming back to later. When we get to about chapter 56 or so, there's still like almost 10 chapters left in the book. We're in full Sanderlanch at this point. You know, information is coming thick and fast. Brandon does what Brandon always does, I've noticed in these, is he starts to intentionally bury little nuggets of information in the Sanderlanch, knowing you're going to miss them. And where I think he buried the nuggets in this one is in the offhand narrator comments that Hoid makes. You get going, events are going fast, you're meeting a dragon, Tress is outwitting Crow, the sorceress is coming in, there's a cat chasing a rat around the room, like things are going crazy. And Hoid is constantly making these little comments on the side that make no sense. It'll just be like, oh yeah, I did that once, on and on and on. Or as I experienced once with a friend, such and such and such. And it's just like, what? There's so much little bits of like inside references that we don't have enough information to get. I think we're going to be coming back and reading this section again someday to maybe try and pick out what Hoid is talking about here. to give you guys a more specific example, and what I think was the most interesting one that did make at least a little bit of sense to me, there's a scene where I think it might be the scene actually where Tress is realizing that Huck is working against her. Kind of. I guess the food is getting thrown overboard.
Yeah,
or
where they're bailing food. Yeah.
Yeah. Tress like confronts Huck, Charlie, with all this. And Huck says, "I did it for your own good." Hoyt then goes on a tangent for like 2.5 paragraphs, basically coming to the final statement to say, that statement, "for your own good, I said that once with 16 other people." And then he just goes back to the story and keeps going. And I was like, hold on a second. Hold on a second. 16 is important. Always has been. I know that Hoy was involved at some level in the shattering of Adonalsium. Is he referencing that? Did he and 16 other people think they were shattering Adonalsium for his own good?
That would be the insinuation.
And that's kind of the big question. But then a secondary question immediately follows it up in my mind. My math is not checking out. Me and 16 others is 17, not 16. We've gotten a couple mentions that Hoyd was offered a shard and declined it. It's a big important point, I think. Others were offered to become a vessel and accepted. Hoyd was offered and did not. So were there 17 shards or 16 shards?
I think that's a good question, but I think the answer is simply, I mean, it could be, we've been lied to this whole time and there's 17. But I think the easy answer is, he said no and gave it to someone else. And so he was offered one of the 16, said no, gave it to maybe somebody else who wasn't going to get one. I don't know.
Is it then just happenstance that they were a band of 17 and Adonalsium happened to split into 16 pieces?
I don't know. Maybe they knew beforehand that he would split into 16. And so he...
We don't
turned it down before they even attacked Adonalsium, and so they brought 17 people.
Unrelated, like, kind of different train of thought. We've never seen a shard that's alive, that's not splintered, right? With that assumption, that does not have a vessel, right? Like, there's no just shard floating around without a vessel. The reason I'm saying this is, like, if he declined, is it possible that a shard could kind of, I don't know, wither? I'm thinking of, like, could it wither away? Could there have been a 17th shard that no longer exists because it had no vessel and therefore, I don't know, died or faded into the cognitive realm or spiritual realm? I don't know. Something like that we haven't ever seen anything of. Is it possible that there's an element of Adonalsium that has sort of perished for that reason? There wasn't another person who took it, but it just had nothing or something. I don't. That's really far-fetched. I'm kind of headcanoning, throat shooting stuff out there. But that's a thought that I've had, is every time we've seen our shards, if the vessel of the shard dies, they have a new person who steps in and accepts it. You know, we haven't ever seen it left hanging.
I won't immediately dismiss it, but I don't think it's likely. But it's not it headcanon all you want. I think it's good. But as far as I understand, it's been confirmed that at the shattering, he split into 16 pieces and 16 vessels immediately grabbed them.
That's my understanding as well. Yeah.
What now, current day Cosme or whatever you want to say that is, whether that's Stormlight 5 or whatever, there are plenty of vessels, or, I'm sorry, there are plenty of shards that have no vessel at the time. Dominion and Devotion have been killed and are just hanging out. Honor on Roshar has been de-vesseled and is just hanging out. So, yes, that there are the one on Threnody. Which one's the one on Threnody? I should know that. I don't. Whatever the one on Threnody is, where it's just kind of flipping the world upside down, making everybody into shades accidentally. That power is still very much there. It just doesn't have
ambition or something like that.
No. Oh no, you're right. I think it is ambition.
Maybe I'm trying to remember. I thought it started with A.
I thought it was ambition and devotion were on Cell.
No, dominion and devotion.
Yes, I know it was the two D words. I remember.
I think you're right. It might be ambition because I always want to say autonomy, but that's not correct. Okay. Ambition. I think you are correct. Is the one that broke on Cell.
Okay.
I mean, on Threnody.
Either way, I will say my most anticipated moments to ever read are, first off, looking forward to book 5, Stormlight book 5. Second off, if we ever get a full canon Hoid history, you know, of like the Shattering or something like that, that is by far the moment I most want to see.
Yeah.
I'm sure me and everyone else, but have to say it.
I agree with you, but really, unless it's in a secret timeline that Brandon's not telling us, it's not on the calendar. He has, you know, his next 10 years planned, and it's not on there.
Yeah, I understand. I understand, but maybe we'll get that one day when I'm like retiring, 65 or something.
Yeah,
Brandon's writing from the nursing home.
All right. The sorceress is banished from the planet. She takes her security cameras and laptops and robots all with her in her spaceship and sets off into the Cosmere at some future point. I'm sure we'll see her at some point. And then we end the book with Tress returning home with Huck the Rat. And Hoid gets to alter his curse. So when they return home, Huck writes her a poem and he is released. And that's pretty much, they live happily ever after. Tress is acknowledged that she no longer wants, you know, the quiet life of washing windows and et cetera at home, picks up her family and sails off in her new ship, the Two Cups. So, what do you guys think of the epilogue of the book?
I really enjoyed it. It felt pretty akin to the other Secret Project book that we've read. Of like it was a nice, how you think of a nice traditional epilogue. You get to see the heroes at home, happy, they've settled into their new life together, kind of thing. And it was really nice, very refreshing, very sweet. Yeah, I thought it was also pretty quirky and fun with how, like, Huck has to write a poem and just all the stuff with that, I think was pretty funny and all. But I certainly enjoyed it.
When's the last time we got an actual conclusive ending to a book? I mean, the Lost Metal is a pretty conclusive ending, but before that, I don't know if I could point to one besides Yumi.
Maybe we'll get one in Stormlight 5.
We don't need to talk about it now, but Stormlight 5 could go any direction. I really don't know.
I was going to say, I don't think we will get a conclusive ending in Stormlight 5 for the record, but yeah. Not even in like Warbreaker. I mean, it was an ending, but it wasn't super like, and everyone went home and they were happily tucked into their beds and
right
with their loved ones. You know, it wasn't sweet and more joyful like this.
One thing about the ending I had to think a little bit about to decide whether I liked it or not was the sorceress leaves without uncursing Charlie, and, or even like states that it's not possible. And then it like sets it up to be this, oh no, Charlie is stuck as a rat for the rest of life. And then in like two sentences in the epilogue, it goes, eh, but Hoyt found a loophole and it was fine. And I was like, okay. Given the fairy tale nature of this story, I think it's fine. If we were in any other story, I'd have problems with the very loophole nature of the resolution of that. But it's fairy tale, and it's Hoyt, and it's Tress and Charlie, so it's fine. It's fine.
Fair enough. Yes, I agree with you that if it were a Stormlight book, I wouldn't like that. But because it's Tress and because it's not trying to be anything but Tress, I didn't
care. Right.
Anything else on the general plot before we zoom out a little bit and talk about what we've learned moving forward in the Cosmere?
The only other thing I wanted to point out regarding the plot is Elliot was really the one who predicted it, but very spot on with Huck is Charlie. And I just want to say, first off, congrats. Well done, Elliot, on another good prediction. But it was very, very akin to the traditional Princess Bride story, which I don't have positive or negative thoughts for, because that's what this book was based off of. So that perfectly makes sense. But it was a fairly straightforward, prediction, something to kind of anticipate in the story. But that was just something I needed to point out. The prediction was spot on.
I appreciate the kudos. That one was, I was a little proud of myself at the end there. Although that was another one that just seemed, I was thinking about the Princess Bride throughout a lot of the beginning of this. One, because I knew that going into it, that was an inspiration for the story. Two, it feels very much like the tone of that book when you, and the movie, the movie's really like spot on to the book, by the way, Princess Bride. And so I'm just thinking about that through. And then as soon as we saw Huck, it was like, oh, okay, the boyfriend's back in disguise. Got it. And like almost to the level where I almost feel like maybe I shouldn't tell people that when I'm selling this book to them.
Yeah.
Like maybe I should not say, oh, do you like Princess Bride? Cause that inspired Brandon to write this. It's almost, if they're going to think enough about it, be pointing them towards spoilery stuff to even say that. So I'm almost going to maybe try and couch it as a fairy tale. It's a fairy tale story by Brandon Sanderson set in the Cosmere.
Yeah. I didn't think about this until this read, but it goes even further to where in The Princess Bride, Wesley is pursuing Buttercup and befriends some of his antagonists after like dethroning what's his face. I don't remember his name. The Sicilian guy.
Vicini,
yes. So he dethrones Vicini and then assumes some of his crew to help him. That's what Tress does. She dethrones Crow and then, befriends some of Crow's crew who are kind of just along for the ride. They don't really want to be pirates or, thieves or whatever. So, yeah, I also thought of that as we were going through the dragon trap chapters. It's even a battle of wits.
Yeah. Yeah. One last thought before we go to kind of bigger picture stuff, just super, super quick. What are your guys' thoughts on in some of the chapters we saw here towards the end, actually, where Tress is working with the flare gun and she's working with the verdant ethers. There's a couple scenes where she's like controlling the vines with her thoughts. The vines, yep, like burst out and she's, watering them to keep them growing. And she just like thinks what she wants them to do and they do it. And I couldn't help but think about in that moment, that has got to be the softest magic we've seen yet from Brandon. You know, Brandon talks a lot about hard and soft magic systems and overall tends to lean towards very firm, physical, science-y type magic systems. And everything that we see has some kind of an explanation or a give and take, you know, resource magic based, you know, everything has a cost, all this, yada, yada. And then here's Tresh just thinking it and the vines do it. What would you guys take? And I'm not criticizing it by any means. I have nothing against a soft magic system. It just felt a little bit surprising to have a Cosmere setting and then a very unexplained magic going on. What did you guys think?
This actually segues well into our zooming out, because ethers as a whole, I agree, right now are very unanswered. And I wonder if Sanderson is trying that on purpose as a just trying it out to see if he needs to explain everything immediately, because I have every understanding and assumption that ethers will be explained at some point in the future. But with Tress and the Lost Metal now, they've been introduced without any explanation. I mean, we begin exploring them in this book, but the Lost Metal, Prasandva shows up with his ether friend and you're just like, what? What is going on? I really have zero idea what's going on. And then in this book, he's pushing ethers more. Obviously, they're front and center on the moons here. But zooming out, once we've finished this book, I was going to ask you guys about ethers. How do you feel about them moving forward? Are you excited to learn more? They're very strange. They're very odd. And when I first read this book, I was not impressed by them. I wasn't intrigued by learning yet another new magic system. But on reread, I am interested in ethers and the relationship that is explored in this book. There's the Midnight Essence, where you specifically have to have a bond with it. And then there's more of a primal ether where it's just kind of a chemical reaction. But there's still a bond, like you were saying there, Elliot, where she has given it water and then can kind of control it, but not really. So I guess I'll just push this maybe to Paul of, are you excited about ethers moving forwards? How did they do for you in the presence of this book?
So this has been an interesting thing, and this is something I've wrestled with a bit. I totally see what you're saying, Elliot, by it being a soft magic system. It feels softer than the other ones where we see hard, vivid rules. I have this metal, I ingest it, I have that much to burn to use that power, you know, and Stormlight, all the things. This is different. To me, it feels like Aethers and this whole system is something that Brandon wants to incorporate going forward, but is kind of having to do so piece by piece, bit by bit. I'm assuming that this way we will learn more rigid rules and things over time. I don't know when. I don't know if it could be. I don't know. I don't think we'll see anything like this in Sunlit Man. But we could learn a tidbit or something. Could meet another character, who knows. But as far as, I feel like I didn't premeditate this. I didn't really think too much about it while reading, but thinking about it now, I'm not super invested in Aethers. I'm not like, wow, I really need to know more right now. I am curious because it feels, my question, I might have to ask this. My question about ethers is, are ethers just from this planet, or are they kind of all over? I don't remember for sure. But for me, I like the magic systems of being like, this is what they do on Cell. Like, this is how the magic system works there. This is where we can maybe see it around the Cosmere and things like that. This felt like it's a new mechanic, Cosmere-wide, and not to the planet, or is this specific to this planet?
So from my understanding, they're parasitic to this planet. They've shown up and kind of taken over. And so moving forward, they are other places like we see on Scadrial. And they do have specific interactions like you might expect with Investiture. So what we've learned in this book is Silver kills them like it does Investiture. Mm-hmm. And Tress uses steel and iron to manipulate its growth. So as she's becoming a Sprouter, she learns that iron and steel are in this tool that she has so that she can force it one way or pull it another way and kind of sculpt what she's making. So you're right. Ethers moving forwards are certainly going to be a thing. It's just a really interesting concept of how they interact with normal Investiture rules that we have already.
I think the only problem I have with it personally is I like that each planet is kind of known for its magic system. And it almost feels like this is a blanket that's going to be kind of put over all the Cosmere systems we have. I don't know if that will be the case. It is interesting to see how it reacts with other things we've seen, like metal. I mean, we haven't seen any other instance like this, right? Like, we've seen other magic being used on, like, the planet it doesn't originate on. We've seen breaths being used other places and things, but not like a direct, unless it's a universal thing like silver or aluminum or something like that, I'm sure. So I think that's my only hesitation or what feels weird. I feel like Aethers might be this, like, blanket put over the magic systems or tool added to all the magic systems or something like that. And I feel like I kind of liked having each unique magic system kind of on its own and being like, oh, someone's using this, they're from this planet, or they've been to this planet or something like that. If someone pops up with ether powers, it's still kind of a wild card in my head, I guess. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but my understanding is this is not where the ethers are from, you know, now. So, yeah, I have mixed feelings. I feel like I just need more explanation and more purpose. Yeah. Especially if it gets more into our mainline series going forward.
You mentioned that we haven't seen too much crossover. Like, you may see Hoid be a light weaver or a Mistborn or something where he's not supposed to be. But something that we've actually have seen that was out of context for you, that which we haven't gotten to revisit yet, which I do plan on doing so before Stormlight 5, is in the epigraphs of Rhythm of War, Navani has a journal. And she writes about how different metal interacts with different spren and fabrials, and how you can use specific metals to manipulate spren and even like kill spren and, you know, stuff like that. So kill is the wrong word. But anyway, at the time, it didn't mean much to you, but Navani was figuring out, okay, if I put this spren in a steel cage, it can make a fabrial that helps lift elevators. And at the time, you're like, okay, yeah, whatever. But had you read Mistborn, that would have meant a lot more to you. And you could have then thought, okay, well, what would this metal do with this type of spren? So that is in our future, I believe, in the very near future. And I think we will revisit that and go highlight some of that in Rhythm of War before Stormlight 5 comes out.
That is fair. I think the only difference now then is we've finished this book where we've seen Aethers and we've seen some of this power, but we don't fully understand it still. We don't understand the rules where whenever we finished, once we've made it far enough into Stormlight, once we finished Warbreaker, once we finished Mistborn, we understand. I feel like we have a very clear, rigid understanding of how the magic works And I think this is just different. So you're right. It is soft, but I feel like that's a temporary thing. I feel like Brandon isn't going to leave this. Maybe he didn't have it all figured out when he wrote the secret project, and we'll figure that out later. But I'm hoping for more boundaries, I guess, more rigidity for this, because I feel like it would be way more in line with everything else going on.
I think he might have to be a little bit careful with ethers, though. This could have the potential to really complicate magical interactions. We've already got some crazy complicated possible. Schedule alone gets pretty wacky when you start combining the three different magics on that planet. If we enter into some, I don't know which story it's going to come in, Mistborn maybe, where now you've got magic from five different planets and ethers all happening in the same, you know, extended sequence of events. I think that could push it towards the starting to get impossible to follow for a lot of readers. And so,
yeah,
and I think Brandon knows this. And I think ethers might be something that he's going to have to be a little bit light-handed with. He's going to have to bring it in at key moments. But if we jump, you know, back onto Scadrial and all of a sudden now we've got Surge Binders and Allomancers and Etherbound going all over, it's going to get so crazy so fast. I think Brandon has to be careful with it.
Something I'm actually really curious about. We know on the calendar is Mistborn Era 3, Book 1, Mistborn Era 3, Ghostbloods, and Elantris 2, and maybe Elantris 3. I'm really curious how Cosmere involved Elantris 2 is going to be, because you could go one of two ways with it. He could go with, you can go from Elantris to Elantris 2, or he could go with, you can't. You have to go from Elantris and then go read everything else and then come back to Elantris 2. Because, you know, knowing everything that we know now, you could get really crazy really fast with Elantris 2. Or you could just hang out with Sereni and Raoden. I'm really curious which one it'll be.
Same. Question for you guys about this planet. Lumar, apparently, is the name of this planet, which I had my eye out. And similar to the other secret project, we don't get it till the very end. I was also on the lookout for, do we have a shard on this planet? And while Hoyd casually references a few other shards, it doesn't seem like we got any specific mention about a shard on this planet. And everywhere else, the shards are easy to pick out or at least know the presence of because of their magic systems. They're their specific type of investiture that's powering some type of unique magic system like we've just been talking about. It seems like all the magic here, well, we got some Elantrian magic at the end, right? But most of the magic is ethers, and we've been told that's not shards. So is the conclusion that there is no shard on this planet?
That would be the conclusion I would come to, that this planet is shardless, which may be a first. You're muted, Paul.
Now that we've gotten to the end of this book, I think I do agree. However, the only notable mention for me is while Tress is talking to the dragon, she references something about using her whimsy or like being, you know, having whimsy today or something like that. And
yeah,
it did feel like a distinct hint, because she was also acting, I would say, fairly uncharacteristic to herself. She grows a lot through this story, so that could be argued and pushed back on, because naturally I feel like she's a very kind-hearted little sweet gal who's, you know, set out to save her love. And by the end of the book, we see a way more, you know, adamant, strong-willed woman, right? You know, there's the character growth. However, it feels like a flip switches. I felt very vividly like she showed up ready to be given to the dragon. And then this flip turns in her mind, and she goes full. I wouldn't necessarily describe it as something I would say is whimsical, but something changes, and I feel like there may have been an, it's possible there's an external force. I don't know for sure, but that's the only thing I can point to that I tuned into and was curious about as she references whimsy. Elliot may be finding the quote. I don't know if he found it or what, but she definitely, it's a quote from her. It's not Hoyd talking to you, I'm pretty confident. And I was going to ask, because I don't actually know on the audiobook, I'm assuming that was capitalized.
Whimsy. So that's what I was going to talk about, not. Is that I noticed the same thing, because I think we know that whimsy is a shard. I think we've had a mention in like an epilogue or epigraph somewhere. Some
rhythm of war epigraph. Yep.
Oh, there we go.
Yes.
That we know capital whimsy is a shard. And this seemed like a very whimsical story in a slightly maybe whimsical planet. So I was halfway through the book, very ready to say, ah, yeah, okay, here we go, whimsy. And so, yes, when Tress and whimsy get used in the same sentence, I was quickly ready to go, aha, but it's not capitalized. Okay. It's not capitalized. And I was trying to find it, and I'm in the right chapter, but I haven't found it exactly yet. I thought it was the opposite of what you just said, that it was not Tress that said it, that it was our narrator, Hoyd, that was using that term. So I like would expect it to be capitalized, and it's not. So I don't know. I don't know. I think your logic is very sound, though. I completely agree with everything you said. I think my only hesitance is, one, it's not capitalized, and two, I'm not seeing a magic system. I'm not seeing, like, whimsy investiture on this planet.
I fully agree. I fully agree. I feel like that's just Brandon was playing a little prank or something, especially for the audiobook listeners. So I'm pretty set to let that go if it's not capitalized. And you're right. I was like, either the sorceress or something connected to that is going to be whimsy or connected to whimsy. Either that's the case or there's really nothing else I could point to. And it turned out that was definitely not. You know, we know about Ryana, everything there. So I'll kind of drop that. I think you're right. I don't really, I didn't see any shard evidence on this planet.
Yeah. If Elliot didn't bring it up, I would have. I also had the same thought. Went and looked it up. It is not capitalized. So, yeah. Do with that what you will.
Guess he can't win them all.
Anything else, gentlemen?
I don't think so. I've got other thoughts to talk about the book as a whole, but that's next week with our next episode. So I think we've covered the chapters pretty well for my notes.
Sounds good. Let's reconvene next week. Thanks for joining me, Paul and Elliot.
See ya.
Toodles.